I'm going to start by reading a poem by Portia Nelson. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. But it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. And then the last verse, I walk down another street. Sound familiar to anybody? So from a Zen point of view, this is about seeing our conditioning, seeing our patterns, our habituated ways of thinking and acting and being in the world. So it's about seeing our patterns, seeing our resistance to seeing our patterns, and finally seeing through our patterns and finding freedom from the conditioning. When we talk about spiritual freedom in Zen, what we're talking about is freedom from our conditioning so that we can experience the world freshly. And we have tools to help us do that. I'm going to talk about one of them today. And this one, I'm going to talk about deep questioning, and I'm going to be using this book. It was written by Susan Blackmore. It's called 10 Zen Questions. This book is years old. I mean, I've had it for years. I can't even keep the pages in it anymore. But it has been republished and with a new title. The new title is Zen and the Art of Consciousness. One of the things that's kind of interesting about this is that Susan Blackmore is not a Buddhist. She's a scientist, and she studies consciousness. But when she knew enough about Zen, or she learned about Zen, or somehow she came across Zen, and she realized that Zen could be a very useful way to help her to study the science of consciousness. So she spent years practicing the practice of deep questioning. And as the title suggests, she has 10 questions that she worked with for years. A couple of them actually come from Zen koans. And I'm just going to talk about one of them today. I'm going to talk about the first one. So one of the things that she said in here in the introduction about why she used these questions and why she decided to practice actually what is a Zen practice. She is a meditator. Still, she's not a Buddhist. And you'll notice the difference as we go through this book. I'll be reading passages from it, so you kind of get a flavor both of her voice and also her sincerity. I mean, she practiced with real sincerity for years in her endeavor to study the science of consciousness. And she said, these are the sort of questions which concern the very mind that is asking the question. So her goal was to see whether looking directly into one's own mind could contribute to the science of consciousness. And she wrote that looking directly at her own mind exposed the horrible mess in my mind, the visions, the fears, the anger, the resentment, the guilt, the worries, and the perplexity. So she's a 21st century scientist. Yet her experience sounds an awful lot like Buddha's experience 2,500 years ago when he sat under the Bodhi tree, where he was faced with his fears, his anger, his desires, and his perplexity, his delusion. So I think her practice of deep questioning is worth looking at. It's worth talking about. So the first question that she worked with is on your program. Am I conscious now? So I'm actually going to talk about two ways of working with the question. The first one is just as an intervention to bring you back to the present that you can use all through the day. And she used all through the day. The hardest part about using the question in this way is just remembering that to ask the question. But she discovered something pretty interesting happened whenever she really asked the question, am I conscious now? Try it. Take a minute. Ask the question. Susan wrote, when I asked the question, am I conscious now, I noticed something very odd. The answer was always yes, but I got the peculiar feeling that perhaps a moment ago I had not been conscious at all. It was a bit like waking up, but if so, from what? So waking up from what? I think she's waking up from the same thing that Buddha woke up from, what he called the three poisons, anger, greed, and delusion, and all of their various manifestations and gradations. One of Buddha's fundamental teachings is that the three poisons are the roots from which all of our conditioning arises. So they are the root of our feeling so imprisoned. And according to Buddha, our patterns can be traced back. Each one of them can be traced back to one of the three poisons, if we trace it back all the way to its roots. And that's what we do in Zen. That's what Zen meditation is actually all about. It's about tracing our patterns back to their roots, not through analysis, of course, not with our mind, but through clear seeing by looking directly at our own mental processes until the thought patterns come into view. We start learning how to do this from the first time we sit on the cushion, if we've had instructions. You know, we're told to just anchor our awareness on our breath. We're told not to try and close down on our thoughts, not try to stop our thoughts, because we're trying to see them. We're trying to learn something about the nature of our own mind. So the only way we can do that is by anchoring ourselves and watching the thoughts float by without getting caught by them. Because each time you get caught by it, you're reinforcing it. And without resisting it, because each time you resist it, you're also reinforcing it. But it's not an easy practice. I think everybody in this room probably knows that. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. So when we first start meditating, we often feel lost for a long time because our thoughts come so fast. We might realize that we've been lost in some thought stream for the last 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And there may be some resistance to letting it go, because there's something very comforting about our patterns. So Susan Blackmore wrote, "Vision seems so simple. We open our eyes and there is the world. But what about our inner world? What about insight? Is insight just as simple? We open our eyes and there is our mind." Years ago, I watch a lot of YouTube. I watch a lot of lectures and talks, TED Talks, Zen Talks, any kind of talks on YouTube. And in one of them, I was watching a Zen master give a talk. And somebody asked him something about how do you stop your thoughts? You know, how do you come back? You know, how do you just stop and come back? How do you do that? And the Zen master, of course, he always had, you know, he had a glass of water. And he didn't say a thing. He just picked up this water and he shook it like this. Water splashed everywhere. He just kept shaking it like this and looking around at everybody. And then suddenly he went, bam, and he slammed it down on the floor in front of him. His point, I think, was that, yes, it is that simple. But no, it's not easy. So over and over, for years, Susan asked, "Am I conscious now?" And over and over, we walk down the same street, don't we? And there's a deep hole in the sidewalk. Well, we see it there, but we fall in. We see it there, and we still fall in. Because it's a habit. So throughout the day, we notice that our mind has wandered, and over, we use the question to bring ourselves back. Again, the hardest thing about using deep questioning as an intervention to bring us back into the present is just remembering to ask the question and then keeping it fresh and alive so that it's not something that's rote. When you guys ask yourself the question, "Am I conscious now?" did you get this impulse, like you were, something was, your awareness was coming forward? Did you guys feel that? A lot of people I've talked to felt that. I often feel that. And Susan Blackmore in her book, she talks about feeling that. That coming forward. I want to read another passage that's really interesting. Oh, asking the question always gets the answer yes. So if I keep on asking the question, I should remain conscious as long as the question is alive, shouldn't I? I try, and as the years pass, it becomes easier to keep the question open. No longer does a door quietly close, only to be wrenched open again in fury at having let it close unnoticed once again. Gradually, it is possible to keep asking the question. So, years passed, and she uses this deep questioning. So, now I want to talk about another way of using deep questioning as a practice. And this is holding the question in our body. rather than asking it with our mind. So this is a little trickier than using it as an intervention. And the best place to try and to practice with holding a question in your body is on your cushion. And the point is, the practice is that you're just holding the question. You're not answering it. And what you'll notice, most likely, is how quickly your mind wants to jump in and take over and answer the question. Or else it just wants to jump in and take over and start repeating the question over and over. So this is a very physical way. I mean, something that you can actually do, a technique that has some legs, I think, that will help you to move from your mind, from this discursive thinking, and into the body, and experience a different kind of thinking. Experience a thinking as the body thinks, which is just holding a question. Being open. Allowing the question to open us up, to soften us. Allowing the question to penetrate right down to our cells. Feeling ourselves ask the question, am I conscious now? It's a very rich practice. I hope you guys will try it sometime. You'll probably experience some discomfort too, because the mind desperately wants to take over. I mean, it's not comfortable not falling right into our pattern. At one point, Susan Blackmore talks about she's trying to hold the question. She's trying to keep the question alive by saying, you know, first she asks, am I conscious now? And then she starts asking, and now? And now? And now? So what's happening here? And now? And now? Sounds like a broken record, right? She's fallen into a hole again. Does she even notice, I wonder? Because she didn't say so in the book. Does she even notice that she's fallen into a hole? Because that's her pattern. She's a scientist. She wants to analyze. She wants to study. She wants to be in her mind. That's her pattern. But she's trying to use the question to look at her mind. So by this time, she's been doing this practice for a long time and very sincerely. So how does she not notice that she's fallen into the hole? I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. Our patterns are a refuge. They're so familiar. Even if we know, you know, in our mind, you know, maybe we've been practicing Zen for long enough to know that the patterns are the root source of our suffering. But still, they are the devil we know, huh? I read a story a long time ago that seems to just pop up and be so appropriate in so many different ways. So I'm going to tell you this story, see if you can see where it connects to what I'm talking about. There was a samurai who decided he wanted to start practicing Zen. So he goes out and he finds a Zen teacher and they're practicing together. And one day he asks the Zen teacher, how long can I carry my sword? He's asking, how long can I hold on to my old life, right? How long can I carry my sword? And the Zen teacher said, for as long as you can. For as long as you can. Because seeing how much comfort we take and our familiar patterns is clear seeing. That is mindfulness. That is the first step towards freeing ourselves from our patterns. Seeing how resistant we are to letting go of our patterns is clear seeing. So, wondering how much of this I'm going to be able to actually talk about. when my granddaughter was born, she's 19 now, so, oh God, she just turned 20. she was born on Kodiak Island with a midwife. And this was, she was my daughter's first child. And as is often the case with a first child, there were complications. And these complications caused my daughter to be in even more pain than is usual for a first birth. And at one point, the midwife said to me, when she has a contraction, don't let her close her eyes. If she closes her eyes, she'll get lost in the pain. So that was my job, not letting my daughter get lost in the pain. And Buddha differentiated between pain and suffering, didn't he? Being mindful means that our eyes are not closed, that we don't get lost in our pain, in our anguish, in our grief. We feel it, but we don't become overwhelmed by it. So, Buddha's discourse on mindfulness, called the Satipatthana Sutra. This is what he wrote, or this is what he said. One knows a lustful mind to be lustful, and one without lust to be without lust. One knows an angry mind to be angry, and one without anger to be without anger. One knows a deluded mind to be deluded, and one without delusion to be without delusion. So it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking that mindfulness is a continuous state of calm, right? But life is not like that. But by asking the question, am I conscious now, we notice what is there. We notice what is there. And it's not that we somehow accomplish some high state and hold on to it, which you've probably noticed doesn't work very well. mindfulness is a series of small moments many times. A series of small moments many times. So over and over, you know, we see our habituated patterns arise. Over and over, we pretend not to see it. Over and over, we fall in again. Until I see it there, I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. It does happen. If you stick with this practice and do it sincerely, it does happen. So, I don't know if Portia Nelson, who wrote this poem, was talking about being trapped in a pattern, but it sure seems like she was, doesn't it? Tim often talks about meditation being like walking in mist. You know, we don't even notice that we're getting wet. So, the final verse of the poem, just one line. I walk down a different street. So when you walk down another street, everything that you see and experience is different. It's new. Each step you take is from someplace new. And when you ask the question, am I conscious now, from this place, from this street, it could take you all the way down where there's no differentiation between the doer and the deed. Instead of a separate self, you experience life as a process, a continuous happening. But you're walking just like before, just putting one foot in front of the other, just like before. But somehow everything is different. Are you asking the question, or is the question asking you on this new street? And is there any difference? I'm going to read another passage. I ask again, am I conscious now? And watch as the continuous now does whatever continuous nows do. There seems to be a choice. Grasp at some of the things that are going by and bind them into a now. Or else just let the myriad things keep doing whatever they are doing. There's a flickering of the candlelight, the spattering of rain, the blinking of distant lights. But none is precisely before or after the other, unless I grab it, bind them together, and decide which came first. Indeed, I really cannot say with any of them when any of them is happening. The best I can say is that they arise and are gone. They arise and are gone. So from a Zen perspective, the background from this new street is sometimes referred to as the ground of being, the place from which all things arise and then vanish back into. Arise dependent upon everything else, vanish dependent upon everything else. And this dependent arising and vanishing is happening all the time. So from this street, the sensation of being the seer is not aside from what is being seen. The sensation of being the doer is not aside from what is done. And the sensation of being the knower is not aside from what is known. But it's a sensation. It's a felt sense. So don't try to pin it down because you can't. It's what all the place that all the koans are pointing to. It's what Buddha spent 40 years positioning people to experience. Susan wrote, one more time with Susan Blackmore. Years pass. Am I conscious now? No, I'm not. What? I realize for the first time I can answer no. What if this slippery, difficult, not quite really being here is not being conscious? And I should have been answering no all along. So, I'd like to do a meditation exercise. So if you guys would get comfortable. And what I'm going to do is read through this poem again as you listen to it with your meditative mind and see how familiar it sounds and what it might awaken in your own mind. So if you would just take a few minutes to ask the question, am I conscious now? Allow it to penetrate. Allow it to open you up. Allow it to soften you. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. But it isn't my fault. Down the same street, there's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. And I know that it is my fault. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. I walk down another street. Can you get a felt sense of this other street without any ideas of what it is? Just open yourself up to it. See what's already there. Thank you, everybody. And I want to say thank you to Susan Blackmore for sharing her experience of deep questioning, and also to Portia Nelson for her poem. There's a hole in my sidewalk. So we have about 5 minutes, I think, for any comments. Sure.
Yeah, this might sound like my normal smart aleck, but I think it has a deeper point.
Sure, please.
The other street is also going to have a hole in it.
Life is like that. But maybe we will negotiate this new hole with a little more skill than we did the last one. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, Wanda. I want to say something about the line about falling in and it's not my fault. Because when I hear it, I kind of feel like you're talking about denial or something.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I think a lot of times we fall into holes and it isn't our fault. Because we have human nature and we're conditioned by our families and what was going on before we were born, and we were born into a situation that may be a really difficult or even damaging situation. And mm-hmm. so we have patterns that aren't our fault, but it's still our job to unlearn them.
Right.
But I think we shouldn't blame ourselves for having the patterns in the mm-hmm. first place, because we're human beings and we're social beings, and we get into situations and we just
yes.
get smarter and mm-hmm. wiser about what those situations are, so that we can help ourselves and not fall in.
Yes. Thank you. True, and then, you know, I mean, we can really open this up in whatever way we can. Like, this is not a Zen point. But as you said, even though it may not be our fault, we do have to find some way to take responsibility for it. And thinking that, you know, it's my fault and getting caught in that is just resisting and just falling into another pattern. You know, I mean, people have different patterns when they resist. Some get angry and lash out. Others start feeling helpless, lash in. But these are all the patterns that we see. So, yes, thank you. Absolutely, what you say is true. Sure.
Well, kind of going to the denial, like the first two stanzas are, it's not my fault, it's not my fault. And then when you get to the third stanza, it's like this realization or this awakening of, oh, it is my fault, and here's the process that I'm going to do to try and fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the last stanza, she's obviously figured out, okay, I mean, that's sort of kind of how I interpret it as well.
Yeah, and, you know, seeing it like, again, this is not a Zen point, but if we were going to see it from a Zen point of view, the first two stanzas, it's not my fault, it's not my fault, is also an expression of ignorance, right? This is where we all start. And then gradually, as we're walking down the path, this is the path of clear seeing. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? There were a lot of hands. Yeah.
Just a quick, what struck me again, I keep having to remember this, idea.
It's not your fault.
Something or resisting it actually strengthens.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that's not obvious at first to a person.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like we're addressing it by fighting it, or like, I'm not going to let it happen to me again, but all I'm doing is making the distraction stronger.
Yeah. You know, and I think it's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because people often, especially when you're new and you're first getting instructions about meditation, you don't really realize the depth of the wisdom that's contained in something as simple as you let go of the thought without any reactivity at all, without any comment. You just let it go and you come back. Because we know that any kind of frustration or any kind of resistance is just reinforcing the pattern. And as you say, it's not obvious. But, you know, I mean, people have to, you know, we can only take one step at a time, you know, and then eventually they start to, you know, if they hang around, they start waking up to the depth of these little gems that were offered right from the very beginning. Thank you. Sure.
I hear you say that, like, fighting with tofu.
Fighting with tofu. yeah, go ahead.
And you know. It reminded me of when you fall in the hole and you see. That's a very scary moment for me.
Mm-hmm. I think it is.
It's super scary.
Yes.
Because no matter that shithole, it's mine. I know it.
That's the devil, you know. Yep. Yeah. And, you know, it's why we talk about, you know, the unknown. It can be intimidating, because not only is it unknown, but it's unknowable. And not only that, but the rational mind cannot figure it out. If your mind tried to figure out what I was saying right at the end, you're really going to be in a hole. Because it's an experience. It's experiential. It's nothing for the mind to grasp. Jason.
I guess I'm trying to resolve the part where you were saying the doer is not separate from the doing. Resolve that with wanting us to be this conscious choice the person makes to walk on a different street, but the line isn't that, actually. It's just, it's not, I choose to walk on a different street, which there's like some fight in that, right? There's this thing of fighting.
Yes.
I'm going to stop doing this behavior and choose to go on down a different street. It's just, I walk on a different street.
Yes. And that, again, from a Zen point of view, like, you know, we can ask the question, we can hold the question, we can practice with the question in all sorts of different ways. But at some point, we have to let go of the question and allow the question to start doing the work. Because that's the only way we get on a different street. Because we don't know how to get on this different street, right? We might have some ideas about how to get on this different street. But that's why you have a teacher, and the teacher is so important, because the teacher can point out to you, that's just your idea. You got to let it go.
I feel an emotional trigger too when I realize how I'm falling down the same hole over and over again and start to see the pain and suffering it's caused me, realizing others go through it. I feel a natural urge to grieve. Like, I want to cry and grieve it. I almost feel like that's a step of like, okay, I've done it for so long, it's so familiar, I almost need to cry, let it go, and kind of mourn it.
Yes. Grieving is how we heal. So it's our, when we attach to the grieving and start thinking about our grieving rather than feeling it in our body where it is healing, we start thinking thoughts like, how do I always end up here? This is not fair, yada, 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 I shouldn't feel this way. And that's the difference between pain and suffering.
I was about to say, actually, I think grief is a passage to get walking down another street.
Yes. Yes.
Rwanda, mm-hmm. I had this reaction of, like, viewing myself as a frog jumping into the hole. I don't want to get out of it again. So it's kind of like, okay, I know it's there. Let's go ahead and just jump in. You know, kind of purposefully.
Well, maybe you're the bodhisattva that's going to jump in to help somebody get out because you've been there. You know how to get out. We need people like you. Yeah. Yeah, hi.
Yeah, I had a question of your opinion. The metaphor I love and the idea of a whole, I kept asking myself, why did the author choose a different street rather than fill the hole?
Fill the hole.
So I'm curious what you thought on that. Because I feel like she specifically chose. So to me, it says that some things are.
Well, this. What would I say to that? You what?
Did some.
You know, having to feel like we having to fix things all the time is also a pattern. You know, first we need to see ourselves clearly, and then with a clear mind, then maybe we can discover the best way to fill the hole. Okay? Thank you.
Well, and don't the holes always exist?
There'll always be another hole. Because, you know, falling in the holes, that's how we learn. You know? And there'll always be another hole, because there's always something new to learn.
Or the same hole that we should go back to.
Until you've seen it clearly, yes. That would be your hole. You just slap your name right on that one. Yeah, Jason.
I just thought maybe that's the same street seen in a different way.
That is another way of seeing this poem. Yes. There's not just one true way. Thank you, everybody.